This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a recording of our event, London Images as Evidence, Bilder als Beweise, in cooperation with the Rethinking Modern Europe seminar at the Institute of Historical Research. It is part of the series Facing Nazi Crimes, European Perspectives After 1945, organized by the Deutsches Historisches Museum and the Documentation Center German Occupation of Europe in the Second World War. This European event series explores the social and historical context of the early exhibitions on Nazi crimes organized between 1945 and 1948. How did the exhibitions relate to the early visual, documentary, legal, political, and historical efforts to address the German occupation and its crimes? How were they received and what influence did they have on today's culture of remembrance? The exhibition The Horror Camps, displayed in the reading room of the Daily Express in London from May 1945, featured enlarged photographs from the liberated Nazi camps. It prompted questions about the relationship between image and evidence, as well as the public use of degrading images, which remain profoundly relevant to this day. Axel Bangert, Janina Struck, James Bulgin and Paul Betts discuss these questions against the backdrop of changing historical conditions and curatorial practices.
Good evening, and thank you, Michael, for the kind introduction. In her acclaimed work on photography, Susan Sontag remembers how, as a 12-year-old girl, she first encountered photographs of the liberated Bergen-Belsen and Dachau concentration camps, showing countless emaciated and abused bodies, both of the dead and of survivors. I quote, "Nothing I have seen, in photographs or in real life, ever cut me as sharply, deeply, instantaneously. When I looked at those photographs, something broke. Some limit had been reached, and not only that of horror. Something went dead, something is still crying." End quote. Published in the late 1970s, Sontag's reflection attests to the impact of the photographs taken by British and American army photographers during the spring of 1945, when the first Nazi camps on German soil were liberated. Since then, it has been frequently cited to illustrate how powerfully these images have shaped our memory and thinking about Nazi crimes, particularly the Holocaust, an influence that persists to this day. Yet, the photographs and film footage of the liberated Nazi camps did not always occupy a central place in collective memory. For a long time, relatively little attention was paid to how these images were produced and how they first entered the public sphere. How did British and American army photographers and cameramen approach the task of documenting mass death and unspeakable suffering? How did the populations of the Western Allies at the end of a long and brutal war respond to these images? How were they circulated widely enough to become known in the immediate post-war period? And at what point, for a considerable time, did they fade from view? A prime example for addressing these questions is the exhibition The Horror Camps, which opened in London on the 1st of May 1945, shortly after the liberation of Buchenwald, Bergen-Belsen and Dachau, among others, and just a week before the unconditional German surrender. Organized by the Daily Express newspaper and held in its reading room on Regent Street, the exhibition presented blown-up images of the liberated camps to large crowds of visitors. Revisiting the horror camps, its genesis and reception, allows us to better understand a key moment in the early formation of memories surrounding Nazi crimes. The exhibition provides a foil for examining how our perspective on these crimes has evolved over the past 80 years, both in terms of historical understanding and representation in museums. It also highlights ongoing challenges in trying to convey Nazi crimes through historical images, even if the ways we respond to these challenges have changed quite radically over time. In what ways can images serve as evidence of historical crimes? How did the horror camps, with its direct presentation of atrocity images, shape perceptions of Nazi crimes? And what, in turn, remained hidden from view? How should we address the ethical implications of showing photographs that degrade the victims, particularly in exhibition contexts? These are some of the questions that may form part of tonight's discussion. In On Photography, Sontag describes the impact of the photographs from the liberated Nazi camps as, I quote, a negative epiphany, end quote. Yet, we should not treat these images as if they revealed an unchanging truth. They too must be placed in context to be properly understood. Ultimately, we must view the horror camps as part of a much broader phenomenon of post-war exhibitions, which, set against the backdrop of widely varying experiences of war and occupation, addressed Nazi crimes in different ways. These exhibitions were an extremely important medium for public engagement with Nazi crimes, attracting hundreds of thousands of visitors at the time, but are largely forgotten today. Six of these post-war exhibitions are featured in the exhibition On Displaying Violence, First Exhibitions on the Nazi Occupation in Europe, 1945-1948, curated by Agata Pietraszyk, which will open at the Deutsches Historisches Museum on the 24th of May. Apart from the horror camps in London, it will include exhibitions in Paris, Warsaw, Liberec, and Bergen-Belsen. As part of the supporting program, we aim to deepen the exhibition's engagement with early responses to Nazi crimes in the United Kingdom and Europe. To this end, it was a conscious decision to hold part of the program at the sites where the post-war exhibitions were held, and to engage with local experts to gain a deeper insight into their significance and impact. In doing so, we hope to create a more transnational perspective on the Nazi war and occupation in Europe, its violent realities, and long-term consequences. In fact, this transnational perspective is one of the defining features of the planned documentation center, Nazi Occupation of Europe in the Second World War, the realization of which the Deutsches Historisches Museum was entrusted with by the German Bundestag in 2023. We are immensely grateful to the German Historical Institute London for hosting this event with us. I would like to express my sincere thanks to the director, Professor Christina von Hodenberg, the Deputy Director, Dr. Michael Scheich, Research Fellow, Dr. Miriam Brusius, and PR and Events Coordinator, Kim König, for their exceptional support and seamless organization. Last but not least, we are delighted that we have been able to bring together some important and thought-provoking voices on the visual history and museum representation of Nazi crimes for this event. For the panel discussion, we will be joined by Professor Paul Betts from the University of Oxford, as well as by Dr. James Balsam from Imperial War Museums. However, before we begin the panel, I am pleased to welcome Janina Struck, who will deliver tonight's keynote speech. Janina is an independent scholar, documentary photographer, lecturer, and writer, whose influential work focuses on the role of photography and the representation of war and the Holocaust. Her latest monograph, Photography and Resistance, Securing the Evidence in Nazi-Occupied Europe, was published with Routledge earlier this year. We are thrilled that Janina has agreed to share her insights on the London exhibition The Horror Camps with us. So, without further ado, Janina, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Axel, for that warm introduction. And I'd like to thank the Deutsche Historical Museum for inviting me to this very special event, and to the German Historical Institute. It's really a pleasure to be here, and it's a great honor. So thank you. I'm just going to, before I begin my talk, I just want to say that I'm going to be showing some fairly graphic images, because I'm showing images that were exhibited in London in 1945. So I just wanted to make everyone aware of that before I show the pictures. So during April and May 1945, the story of the Nazi concentration camps in Western Europe began to unfold. Newspapers, magazines, and cinemas on both sides of the Atlantic were flooded with images taken by British and American army photographers and photojournalists on the liberation of the camps. The images showed starved, emaciated faces, naked, tangled corpses stacked in mass graves, and those barely alive in the most unimaginable conditions. At Bergen-Belsen, liberated by the British Army on the 15th of April 1945, approximately 60,000 emaciated men, women, and children were found in desperate need of medical attention, and more than 10,000 decaying corpses were strewn around the camp. When the first photographers from the British Army Film and Photographic Unit, the AFPU, began to arrive, they were unprepared for what they saw. AFPU photographer Sergeant Norman Midgley described his experience of Belsen in a letter to his family. "Today," he wrote, "I visited a German concentration camp at Belsen. I saw some of the most horrible sights imaginable. No words can describe this place. I am convinced that Nazis are not human beings, but vermin that must be exterminated." He described the hundreds of bodies laying about, which he said were piled in many cases 5 and 6 high. Midgley finished his letter with the following: "I've read about such camps as this, but never realised what it was really like. It must be seen to be believed." Also at Belsen, AFPU photographer Bert Hardy said that although he did not like taking photographs of corpses, "I controlled my feelings of rage for long enough to take some," he said. Bert Hardy made a point of carrying around a contact print of one of his most horrifying pictures. He wanted to show it to Germans, he said, who did not believe that such things had really happened. On the 22nd of April, the head of the British Ministry of Information, film section, Sidney Bernstein, visited Bergen-Belsen to see for himself. Devastated by what he saw, he immediately shelved all previous film projects and began to plan an Anglo-American production about the camps for the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, or SHAEF. By June that year, at Bernstein's request, the Hollywood filmmaker Alfred Hitchcock had joined him in London to work on the film as a treatment advisor. As more and more camps were liberated, British and American delegations of dignitaries and politicians, editors and journalists, went to witness the camps for themselves. Buchenwald and Dachau, liberated by the Americans, became the focus of macabre tours and endless photo opportunities. Visitors were photographed peering inside the crematoria or standing alongside piles of corpses. American soldiers with cameras were encouraged to take their own photographs to show to those back home who may have been sceptical of official images, including at Nordhausen, where this picture was taken. Such was the glut of atrocity images in circulation that some questioned what could be achieved by looking at images of atrocities. The British Conservative Member of Parliament, Mavis Tate, who was part of a delegation to Buchenwald, said about photographs, and I quote, "They are infinitely less terrible than the reality we saw, because you can photograph results of suffering, but never suffering itself." On the 24th of April, the Daily Mirror published an image of Mavis Tate in a group delegation at Buchenwald, gazing at a pile of naked corpses on the left-hand side. The Daily Express published the same photograph, but with piles of corpses cropped out, with the headline, "British MPs at Buchenwald watch a scene too terrible to print." Alongside the photograph, the Express announced that instead of publishing the full-frame image in the newspaper, it was organising a major exhibition in its reading room in central London. That in it would include photographs it considered too graphic to publish. On May the 1st, 1945, a long queue formed outside the Daily Express reading room in Regent Street. They were there to see the exhibition titled Horror Camps. And you can see the title, I think, of the exhibition on the right-hand side. On display inside the venue were dozens of graphic photographs of Nazi atrocities, some printed to more than life size. The word "seeing is believing" was written on display cards and posted around the room. The following day, the Express published this picture with a headline, "The Jackboot Code, Thousands See Horror Camp Crimes in Pictures." It reported how thousands of men and women, some in military uniform, filed past the photograph in shocked silence. It described how some men took off their hats as they went by, and children were not admitted. One of the first giant-sized images to confront the public inside the venue showed more than 40 naked corpses stacked in a shed at Ohrdruf. It was taken by US Signal Corps photographer Walter Cummings. So you see on the left is the exhibition, on the right is the full frame of the image. Another image in the exhibition was taken at Belsen by Sergeant Midgley. You can see just the half of the picture in this left frame and the full image in the right-hand frame. Another photograph in the exhibition, blown up to more than life-sized, was taken by another US Signal Corps photographer. It showed the charred remains of a corpse taken at Gardelegen, where on the 13th of April 1945, more than 1,000 prisoners were forced into a large barn, which was then locked and set on fire. The prisoners were burnt alive. The same photograph was also displayed in an exhibition of camp photographs in the USA titled Lest We Forget. It opened at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. in June 1945. This stage image on the right-hand side, taken at the exhibition, shows an incongruous and unfortunate juxtaposition between the photograph of the charred remains of a victim and the two well-dressed male visitors standing, pointing at the photograph. Another image in the exhibition showed the naked torsos of three emaciated male prisoners. The image was also published on the cover of a catalogue of an exhibition of camp photographs in Belgium in May, the same month as the Express exhibition. One of the men had been cropped out, presumably for aesthetic and compositional reasons, and the heading of the catalogue implies it was taken at Buchenwald, which in fact it wasn't. Another photograph in the Horror Camps exhibition was taken at Bergen-Belsen by a British army photographer. It shows piles of naked, tangled corpses stacked in a mass grave. The Daily Express reported that a Czech lieutenant had stood in front of this enormous image for almost 5 minutes without moving. "What can we do with a nation who permits such a thing?" the Czech lieutenant asked. A soldier from Johannesburg who'd been captured at Tobruk in the North African campaign and freed by the British said, "I should have thought I'd had enough of atrocities, but seeing this is a duty." It's worth noting also here the way in which the image has been cropped in the exhibition. So it's closed into the corpses, and the right-hand side is the what we believe to be the original framing of the image. To gauge public opinion, the social research project Mass Observation carried out a survey at the exhibition. It concluded that everyone who was interviewed felt the deepest horror and revulsion at the pictures. "Beyond description," commented one person. "I couldn't bear to look at them all," said another. "It made me feel sick." But another interviewee had said, "I'm beginning to get fed up with all these pictures in the papers. I know it's very terrible, but you can't keep looking at dead bodies heaped upon each other all the time. You just get used to it, just as we've had to get used to the idea of death all throughout the war." Another person admitted to feeling disgusted by the photographs, not only with the Germans, but with the victims themselves. This type of comment was no doubt encouraged by the dehumanising and undignified way in which those liberated in the camps were often photographed, either partially clothed or completely naked. Added to that was the way in which they were described in the press, for example, as pitiful specimens, skeletons held together with rags. "Wrecks of humanity" or "ape-like skeletons" are a few of the descriptions. Such was the display of images that some of those interviewed said that although they'd heard about the camps during the war, they could not have visualised anything quite so bad. One visitor said, "But I believe it's true. I can see with my own eyes. Pictures don't lie." But others were not so convinced and questioned the truth of the images as evidence. Some were reminded of the atrocity campaign, for example, during the First World War, when British government spread scurrilous false stories and images about Germany. A welfare worker agreed and said, "After the atrocity stories we invented in the last war, people could always defend themselves against such horrors by saying, 'I expect it much exaggerated,' or, 'Of course, it's only propaganda.'" A British Film Army film projectionist, Cyril Charters, who'd witnessed the horrors of Belsen for himself, agreed with the public's cautious attitude. In a letter to his wife on the 15th of May 1945, he wrote that had he not seen the camp, he too might have thought the photographs were propaganda. By late April, the public reaction to the atrocity images began to change. There was a growing sense that the public wanted some kind of revenge against the German nation. Those interviewed spoke of the rottenness of the German race, or how they think nothing of murder and brutality. Another said, destroy the German race once and for all. Added to the images of atrocities, British newspapers published photographs of reprisals. They showed German citizens made to visit the camps to witness the atrocities for themselves, or civilians being made to dig graves or to bury the dead. Some German communities were forced to watch a newsreel film titled Belsen, The Atrocities. At the screenings, British Army cameramen took photographs of the audience before and after the screenings to capture their reactions. On the 16th of June, the popular British illustrated weekly magazine Picture Post published a page of photographs of townsfolk digging graves for victims in their own town square. The headline asked the question, "Whose guilt?" It was accompanied by an article by philosopher Bertrand Russell, who questions the validity of blaming the entire German nation. He wrote that the British government had undoubtedly known about atrocities perpetrated by the Nazis from the beginning, but had continued with its policy of appeasement. If the nation is content to blame the entire German nation, he argued, then we're not understanding exactly what has happened. Russell had made a valid point here. Despite the massive amount of press coverage, there were very few facts. There was a general lack of understanding about the nationality of the prisoners and the purpose of the camps. The majority of victims discovered at Belsen, for example, were in fact Jews, a point largely overlooked in the British press. And little was explained about why there were so many prisoners in the camps in the first place. Seldom did anyone ask the prisoners for their own stories. It was as though the sensationalism of the images became a barrier to understanding. For example, without the facts, the sheer numbers of victims in the camps quoted in the press, sometimes as millions, simply didn't make sense. This underlined just how little information had been disseminated during the war about what had actually happened in Eastern Europe. To the British public, details about the Jewish ghettos, for example, in occupied Poland, or Hitler's final solution, the plan to exterminate European Jews in specially made death camps, remained largely unknown. But more than that, as the Western democracies were absorbed in publicising the horror unearthed by their own liberations, the earlier discoveries made by the Soviet army had been generally ignored. By 1943, for example, the Soviet Union had already concluded war crimes tribunals at Krasnodar and Kharkov. In July 44, when Majdanek, the extermination camp near Lublin in eastern Poland, was liberated by the Soviet army, it went largely unreported by the Western media, as were the tens of thousands who'd been murdered in the camp. When the Russian-born British writer and journalist Alexandra Wirth filed a detailed report about Majdanek to the BBC, it refused to broadcast it on the basis they thought it a Russian propaganda stunt. Majdanek, in fact, was the subject of the first documentary film to be made about a concentration camp, titled Majdanek, Cemetery of Europe. It was completed by a team of mostly Polish-Jewish filmmakers in 1944, but would remain largely unknown in the West for decades. Similarly, when Auschwitz-Birkenau was liberated by the Soviet Army in January 1945, on a date that the whole nation now commemorates the Holocaust, it warranted only a few sentences in the British press and no images at all. As a result of these omissions, the British, as well as the American public, were left with the impression that the camps in Western Europe represented the entirety of Nazi atrocities. In the summer of 1945, negotiations had begun in London between the four Allied powers, the Soviet, the French, the US and UK governments. This led to the creation of the International Criminal Court. In November 1945, the International Military Tribunal opened at Nuremberg. During this period of the tribunal, three more exhibitions opened in London. The aim of these exhibitions was no longer to shock the public with images of atrocity, but to reassure them that the nation responsible for these crimes were not only under control of the Western Allies, but that the growing demand for justice was being met, and that German people were being taught the lessons of democracy. Although the exhibitions did include some atrocity images, the main focus was on documents and artifacts. On the 5th of December 1945, the Nazi War Crimes exhibition, sponsored by the French government and the UN War Crimes Commission, the UNWCC, was opened by the UNWCC chair, Lord Wright. He himself had been on a delegation to Buchenwald. Also present was the French Minister of Justice and former member of the Resistance, Pierre-Henri Teguin. The exhibition had already been shown in Paris, where, according to the Daily Worker, it caused a sensation. The following June 1946, another exhibition titled Germany Under Control opened its doors at the Dominion Theatre in central London. The British Foreign Office suggested that as a publicity stunt, some of the 4,000 British-German POWs who at the time were undergoing a programme of re-education at a POW camp in Buckinghamshire could attend the opening ceremony. Their presence, it suggested, could demonstrate that they were being converted to our way of thinking. The following month, on the 3rd of July, the War Crimes exhibition, the last to be shown in London, opened its doors. There's no evidence it had any impact. By this time, the public were getting tired of hearing about the camps, and any interest in the Nuremberg tribunals was beginning to wane. After the Nuremberg tribunals had ended, the images that had been so powerfully placed in the public memory began to fade from public view. The film that Sidney Bernstein was working on was never finished. He ran into difficulties in late 1945, and the film project was shelved. The 5 roughly edited film reels were deposited in the Imperial War Museum in London, where they lay virtually untouched for 4 decades. The problem was that by the late 1940s, Western liberal democracies had begun to see the strategic importance of rebuilding West Germany as a buffer state against the Soviet bloc. The evil, as far as Western governments were concerned, was no longer Nazism, but it was now communism and the Soviet Union. As a consequence, images of Nazi crimes were quietly withdrawn from the public domain and would gather dust for almost half a century. If they were shown, they were met with hostility and sometimes censorship by the authorities. One example was an exhibition titled Nazi Concentration Camps that opened in June 1961 in the city of Coventry, which had been heavily bombed in the war. It was brought to Britain from Belgium by a group of camp survivors. There were few Nazi atrocities in this exhibition, and in stark contrast to the spring of 45, no images were published in the press at all. In fact, on the front cover of the exhibition catalogue on the left-hand side was a drawing rather than a photograph. And inside the catalogue, there was no photographs. And on the right-hand side, you can see the opening ceremony, the camp survivors and the opening ceremony of the exhibition. The message, according to its organisers, was forgive, but do not forget. And its aim was to give the objective facts to young people to avoid what it called a repetition of the past. Even so, the exhibition was met with condemnation, particularly by the church authorities, who advised the town's population to boycott the exhibition on the premise that it fostered hate. One leading member of the church said it administered to sadism and morbid curiosity. Others suggested it had been sponsored by left-wing groups. In truth, government policy was not to remind the population of the crimes of Nazi Germany at all. In 1960, the British Board of Film Censors had removed images of Nazi atrocities from the first Western European film on the Holocaust, Alain René's Nuit et Brouillard. It was not until the late 1980s and the end of the Cold War that images that had been so vividly displayed in 1945 would be widely seen again. Now Sidney Bernstein's film footage of the camps was edited and a film was created, titled Memory of the Camps. It was released to coincide with the 40th anniversary of the liberations. And I'll end there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Svojina, for this fascinating presentation, which shall provide an ideal backdrop for our discussion. Before we start, I'd like to introduce the two panelists that have joined Janina and me. There's Paul Betz next to Janina. He is a professor of modern European history at the University of Oxford, and his research centers on modern European cultural history in general and 20th century German history in particular. Paul is interested in the relationship between culture and politics in the broadest sense, and this includes photography. I'm only going to mention two of his many publications. Firstly, the co-edited volume, The Ethics of Seeing, Photography and 20th Century German History, published in 2019, and the monograph Ruin and Renewal, Civilizing Europe After World War II, published in 2020. To my right, we have James Fulton. James is head of public history at Imperial War Museums, and he was previously head of content for the new Holocaust galleries at Imperial War Museums, which opened in 2021. He is the author of The Holocaust, published in 2022, and he has written for The Guardian, BBC History Magazine, and The Radio Times. You may also know James as the presenter of the BBC television documentary How the Holocaust Began, aired in 2023, as well as an on-screen expert for numerous other television productions. So we have a bit less than an hour for discussion, and I shall open the discussion to the floor in the last 15 minutes. And that includes also those who are following online. So you will all have chance to ask your questions as well, or the greatest possible number of you at least. Right. So maybe, Janina, a first question just to follow on from your talk and being mindful also of the title of today's event, Images as Evidence. As far as I know, these images from the liberated camps, they were hardly used as evidence in the actual sense of the term in a courtroom, although they were shown that it didn't function as real evidence. So in what sense were these images then seen as evidence in this immediate post-war period in the public sphere, and as evidence for exactly what? It seems from your talk that there were various answers at the time. For some, they showed an abyss of humanity. For others, general barbarity. What were these images seen as proof for exactly?
Well, it was probably exactly that, German barbarity. I mean, as I said in my talk, there was very little information given with this glut of images that were published in the press in America as well as Britain. And the papers were full of, they used some of the most graphic pictures, which probably we wouldn't use today. And that might be an item for discussion as well. There were images actually, though, used in the Nuremberg trials. In fact, the Americans made a film specially for the trials. And again, that was really a sort of bombardment of atrocities, again, probably without, much information. There was a script, but it was, somebody described it like a kind of Hollywood script for a movie rather than any serious documentation or evidence of what has actually gone on, what happened during the war. So the image was really used as, it was really to shock the public rather than to inform the public. Often they were used without knowing which camp they came from anyway. So, they weren't really camp specific in the press, that is. And indeed in the exhibition, as far as I know, they were not labelled as such. It was really just a bombardment of atrocity images.
It's fascinating that you should say that, because that would have been my second question. You showed this one widescreen image of the interior of the exhibition, which I think is the only image we have, really, in order to reconstruct how it looked. And it seems just like one huge installation of atrocity pictures. And I was wondering, were visitors actually able to distinguish what they were seeing? They were seeing images from different camps, as you've been pointing out, and also from one prisoner of war camp, Fallingbostel. So a completely different kind of camp. But it seems that the distinctions were really blurred in that exhibition, and it was just about the horror, really.
I think they were totally blurred. I mean, I don't think there was really any distinction at all. It was really just a massive atrocity images. I don't know how else to describe that, really graphic images, really, that you can tell by some of the reason I included some of the comments, the way people are commenting, it's sort of an immediate reaction rather than, you know, inspiring people to think about what had gone on, asking questions about what had happened during the war. And of course, there was the whole of the story of Eastern Europe missing, in a way. So, of course, there was a lot of information available during the war about what was happening in Eastern Europe, but it didn't, you know, how that kind of narrative was told is another story. In a lot of cases, it wasn't. And we also had a lot of atrocity images coming into the UK from, you know, occupied Poland, for example. But the government tended to be skeptical about reports from Polish sources or Soviet sources or Jewish sources. And of course, a lot of those weren't published or supported by the government to be published. So some got into the press, but not in any major way. And there were a few exhibitions that travelled around the UK during the war, but again, they didn't get much publicity. But yes, so this glut of atrocity images seemingly suddenly appeared in 1945, you know, would have been a shock to the British public, who'd been, you know, pretty badly informed, I'd say, I think.
Also taking Paul and James into the discussion, you mentioned the British government. I mean, it seems that on the political and military level, after the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, for instance, pretty soon there was this idea that these images should have broad circulation. What was the aim behind that?
Well, the focus was no longer Nazi Germany, it was the Soviet Union. And I was going to say it's as simple as that. Obviously, it wasn't simple at all. But in fact, you know, there was the Marshall Plan. The public didn't need to be reminded anymore of Nazi atrocities, because in fact, after the Nuremberg trial, there was the myth that, you know, Nazis had been got rid of, Germany was a democracy, you know, everything was absolutely fine.
I mean, before that, like when the images were taken shortly after the liberation, it seems that a decision was taken, let's disseminate this as broadly as possible in the British public. And I wonder what the military leadership wants to achieve, or how they thought about their aims, if that's possible to say.
No. Well, first of all, I should say congratulations on the exhibition. Thank you for the invitation to come here. And thanks to the team here at GHI for putting this on. One thing you said before about kind of Nuremberg, it is one in which the judges at Nuremberg, of course, are very reluctant to admit these images. They were worried that would be perceived as too sensationalist, too emotional, not necessarily reliable, possibly propagandistic. And so they only use them sparingly, as you said, that particular film about Nazi concentration camps in a very, very kind of limited segment, because they wanted this very tricky and legally shaky war crimes trial. They wanted it to build on very, very firm legal ground. So also they're building their case around the concept of crimes against humanity, which had no legal precedent. So in order to do that, they in a sense wanted to make sure that the trial proceeded in a very kind of conventional legal way. And so for some, they used these imagery as a way of distracting from what was seen as the legal illegitimacy of the crimes against humanity as, in a sense, retroactive justice, right? Of course, that these Nazi leaders were committing crimes that were not crimes in this regime. So to come in later and then put them on trial for crimes that were not deemed as criminal was seen as legally kind of terra incognita, and something they felt was actually not a good way to start a new post-war world in terms of a war crimes trial. So the sensational emotional effect was designed in part to get that effect. One thing that people don't know so much about, which is quite new with research, is that the Nazi leaders in the dock were also filmed. They, in a sense, spent a lot of time with the lighting and, in a sense, the cinematographic theater, if you will, with the idea of, in a sense, building a theater contrition. So they filmed close-ups of Speer, Himmler, these sort of figures. And part of the reason I think that Speer was not hanged, but actually given a long prison sentence, because he, in a sense, plays the role of the kind of penitent Catholic who said that he was misled. He emotes the kind of the emotional shock of some of these images. And there's a lot of close-up camera work on the Nazis in the dock, and made some people, as you said, uncomfortable about what, in fact, what these trials were designed to do. It was a theater of justice, but it was also seen to be a kind of spectacle, using film lighting to, in a sense, put on a kind of display on what the liberal world is now doing in terms of subjecting these particular leaders on trial. Can I just say one thing in response to what you said about the disappearance of these images. I mean, I think you're right about there's an explosion, mass circulation of these images in kind of April, May, June. And they're certainly there for the first 4 or 5 months. But I found in my research that the story changes once the British zone, the occupational zone, is set up in June and the first few months, where it's all about, in a sense, the terrible atrocities, Holocaust related, in the first few months. It soon starts to shift as a number of these photojournalists start to photograph other things. And they photograph a lot of German refugees in the British zone of the course of the summer of 1945 and into that autumn. And they, in a sense, will, there's the Daily Express, picture post, full spreads of, in a sense, the very difficult, harrowing, parlous condition of the British occupational zone. And in fact, a number of these German refugees coming from the East are subject to very, very difficult, harrowing circumstances. So I think that these English, these British photojournalists play an important role in changing the sensibility. It shifts from sympathy toward Jewish victims toward, in a sense, much more sympathy toward these German refugees. It's also victims of this particular war. So you can certainly see it in titles of articles, the homeless hordes, the kind of flotsam, the jetsam of humanity, this effort, in a sense, to much more sympathy toward these refugees, partly because they become a discussion about British civilization. It's an idea of, if we're going to run this new occupational zone, we're using Nuremberg trials partly as a justification for British occupation, we then have to treat these German charges much better than they were treated before. So the test of the superiority of the British conditions in Germany means we have to treat our charges actually quite well. We need to feed them, clothe them, and treat them with dignity. So that's a huge shift in the late summer, early autumn of 1945, but there's a lot of sympathy toward these German refugees. Figures like Victor Golans, for example, the publisher, writes a book called In Darkest Germany, which he goes to Germany 1947 and talks about the harrowing conditions of the British zone, but also features photographs in which he's standing behind a number of these children in terms of these kind of emaciated bodies. So I think in part, it's not just the disappearance of these Holocaust images, it's just the sympathy is starting to shift from these Jewish victims to a number of German refugees. And so that becomes an important shift in the story of sensibility. And I think, so that's part of it. They get, in a sense, replaced by a new particular, and the American discussions in the Senate also pick up this story in which they start to talk about the importance of pouring aid into the American zone with the idea of treating fellow Christians. This becomes particularly important for Lutherans, in a sense, as part of a much larger family under siege. So there's a kind of shift in sensibility toward what have been the obvious victims of the Holocaust to other figures, including the refugees from Eastern Europe.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Did you want to take a step back?
It's such an interesting, I mean, one of the things about the AFPU footage, which I think is it's sometimes a little overlooked, is it wasn't just kind of happenstance that there's such a volume. Once the AFPU got to Belsen, they poured resource into Belsen. So the AFPU resource is actually quite inconsistent insofar as you'd assume that it follows a sort of seamless line from the invasion of Normandy down to Berlin, and it doesn't. It's patchy until you get to Belsen, and then they stayed there and they filmed a huge volume of content. And to your question about what its function was, they're pretty unconditional and pretty explicit about it. At the time, this famous piece of footage where a chap called Gunnar Illingworth, who's this really kind of almost like a caricature British Tommy, isn't it? He says, well, this makes you realize what we've been fighting. And it's absolutely front and center, explicitly stated that this, it's a post-rationalization, but it's a rationalization. It kind of vindicates everything that's led up to that point. And this, unapologetic.
We see
framed in that way.
Kind of reflective justification of the war efforts.
You know? Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
I wanted to take up the point that Paul briefly touched upon, the Jewish experience. What I found very interesting is when you look at the letters and reports written by those British army photographers and cameramen, they're quite clear about the fact that the majority of victims they see at Belsen are Jewish. They mentioned this explicitly. So why, when and how did this information get lost or was suppressed, I don't know, when this exhibition was made? And is this representative of the public sphere more broadly? How is it with newspapers, newsreels, and so on? Do they mention the centrality of the Jewish experience, or is this soon lost from accounts?
My feeling is it doesn't last all that long. It quickly becomes a kind of a sub-story of the Second World War. Shocking for us to understand that today in terms of it's much, much later, decades later, where in a sense moves back to the center of what happened during the Second World War. I mean, in the catalog itself, we talk about, for example, in Paris, the exhibition in Paris, or the one in Warsaw, where in a sense, Jews are not at the center of this. They've become important new kind of stories of restored national identity, the importance of French victimhood and then Polish victimhood. That becomes, in a sense, the kind of frontline story and not so much the centrality and the targeting of the Jews across Europe. So that's actually already by 45, 46, there's a kind of shift in sensibility. Certain groups, of course, I mean, as you have in the catalog, in those countries will respond by, in a sense, mounting counter exhibitions, making a case for the singularity of the Jewish experience there. But they're fighting already what's becoming by 45, 46, a kind of consolidating narrative about that these are very quickly turned into metaphors of, in a sense, nations under siege, whether it be Poland, France, or, you know, certain circles, or for East Germany, for example, that these get quickly elevated into much larger stories of national regeneration, and that the Jewish dimension falls out quite quickly. You have a number of Jewish groups in Britain, the U.S., and also in Western Europe that are complaining about this, how quickly this, in a sense, goes from that singular experience, which has flashed across the press in Western Europe and elsewhere, to one in which it becomes then a metaphor for a much broader story, which is at the exclusion of Jews that actually suffered.
So I think thinking a bit more about how these images actually changed our view of Nazi crimes, we understand they had a very broad circulation, which however then waned quickly. Yeah, and these images were kind of overwritten, as you said. So, but how did they actually change people's ideas of Nazi victims, of Nazi perpetrators? You mentioned these reaction shots taken of Göring and others at Nuremberg. I find this to be very typical of the footage shot at Bergen-Belsen, for instance. There you have ordinary Germans or camp guards being filmed as well, watching their own crimes. So what would you say was the effect of these images long-term in cementing certain ideas of Nazi victims or Nazi perpetrators?
I think what Dan Stone has this phrase that I think is really helpful. He talks about the idea of camps being a world of unspecified suffering. And I think Belsen introduces this kind of prototypical atrocity environment, which in many respects is quite misleading because there's an ahistoricity about that used as sort of synagogic reference. So obviously, Belsen doesn't really testify to the mass murder of Europe's Jews. It testifies to his aftermath. But the imagery was so central that it's almost kind of, and I would say it persists to the present day. I mean, I think this, this idea, people still lazily you conflate death camps, concentration camps into one singular environment, because I think Belsen, particularly Belsen, but Dachau, Buchenwald, Aldruf, again, makes the point, isn't it? Aldruf, how many people have heard of the word Aldruf for our sort of scholarly circles, but they'll see the pictures, but the specificity of the environment is kind of gone. So if that for me is what it did, it created a sort of a Holocaust universe. Mm-hmm. Which then was projected into other environments and somehow, in this really anomalous way, the Holocaust becomes, on one hand, the apotheosis of industrialized, systemized genocide, and also this kind of depraved outbreak of nihilistic, barbaric violence. Do you know what I mean? I think that Belsen, I'm also wary of Belsen footage in that respect, because we try really hard in the gallery to contextualize it, but it almost bursts at the seams, maybe tried to do that. So that's my sense.
And we talked about how these images were then soon forgotten with the onset of the Cold War. But when they were rediscovered in the mid-1980s, were they looked at differently? Were there already these ethical questions about these images? For instance, with the film A Memory of the Camps.
I mean, it's partly a new generation, right? I mean, part of the power of this exhibition is, in a sense, try to reconstruct the shock of the new. But now it's very much the shock of the old, right? I mean, I think these images, in many ways, they're almost too successful, right? In a sense, they have absolutely framed our understanding of the Holocaust, right? It's very difficult to go back to a sense in which, the spring of 45, all the kind of rumors circulating about what in fact had happened there. Once these are mass produced and splashed across European and Western newspapers, there's a sense in which this has become part of our, what do you want to call it, kind of a, global mental archive in terms of it's very, very difficult to understand any of this about the imagery itself. Even if that imagery itself in many ways disappears or at least fades, and then it gets it revived, let's say, we talked about that, gets folded in with the Holocaust television series in 1979, again in the mid-80s. But I think the power there is that it's a new generation in the mid-80s that are actually seeing a lot of these images probably for the first time, or at least in a kind of broader context. But for an older generation, this is, you know, something that if they remember, it's become, in a sense, part of their understanding of that particular. I think that the shock value, it's, you know, once it's been done, I mean, we talk about the Susan Sontag opening, right? That sense in which it seems to have absolutely undone her in terms of the you know, the kind of searing effect of seeing this for the first time. We're all way past that. And in a sense, we already, what you're describing is a certain kind of almost compassion fatigue with some of these images. It's already setting in 3 or 4 minutes. If people can't take any knowledge, right? It's a surfeit of images. And then it's very difficult to go back to, in a sense, that shock value. I think this exhibition does as much as you can, but that way we live very much, not just a post-Holocaust world, but a kind of a world in which the imagery in the Holocaust are almost synonymous.
But what's changed too, of course, is that by the 80s, the Holocaust has emerged. You know, the mere fact that it has a name, you know, it's developed this kind of discrete identity. And to your point about that the images must be too successful, I think those images somehow project to put all victims of the Holocaust, say the, you know, the attempted annihilation, you're choosing to strike uniforms and into concentration camps and into barracks and behind fences, even though obviously historically that didn't testify to the German experience. So the images almost sort of fill those gaps, so they're read in a different way because a different context.
That's a good point. And maybe one could say that in the mid 1980s, that's when they become Holocaust images in the proper sense, because then you had the framework, you have the television series and that's the line, you have the world being established and so on.
But I think there's also interest in survivors as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
So into this, you know, the glut of images come people's stories, and there's, which hadn't happened before. So I think that adds another dimension. And then what happens is you get a move away eventually from the, you know, the atrocity images, the graphic images, into something. I think exhibitions have changed in the Imperial War Museum, I think, haven't they? That in fact you start with, you know, the atrocity images, and then we moved into maybe family snapshots, for example, you know, of taken before the war, and then the victims, so-called, you know, become more human, and we have the family stories and so on. So I think other dimensions have come into that since the 1980s, for sure.
Maybe it's a good point to look into that a bit more closely, curatorial practice regard to these images. James, can you take us back to the time when you started rethinking the Holocaust exhibition at Imperial War Museums? You had the old exhibition in which images from the liberated camps featured quite heavily. You and your team, how did you think about the old exhibition, redoing it, maybe continuing to use such images or not? What was the debate at the time?
So, I mean, we obviously benefited from this huge, vast kind of growth in Holocaust historiography, people like Yanina's work. So there was far more discourse about the ethics of representation than there have been, you know, back in the period of time in the previous exhibition was created, that's the first thing to say. So we consulted really widely, because I started off with this kind of question as a genuinely open question about whether you should use this imagery at all, you know, because there was so much debate and discourse on it. So we consulted with specialists, respective groups, you know, Jewish groups first, from community representatives, etc. I was really surprised by how there was a real kind of discrepancy between some of the quite vocal scholarship and the consensus view elsewhere, because I was expecting to get quite a kind of a divided field, and I didn't. The vast majority of people we spoke to said you should absolutely use this stuff. It's just you should use it judiciously and carefully. So our philosophy was, first of all, to treat imagery, to treat photograph and film as objects, not as illustration. So something which has tangible material for. That was really informed, I would say, and I'm always keen to give her credit for it, by Professor Mike Numbach at Nottingham University. He made the point to me that these images that we've become really used to seeing, as we've just seen on the slideshow, they're really big, existed in the physical world as pocket-sized things that had a kind of an intimacy. And as soon as I thought about their material identity, it sort of reshaped the way that I thought about the way that they fitted into a specific historical context. So we proceeded on that basis. One of the things you'll notice in the galleries, if you do go, as that every single photo reproduction is done at original dimensions with a border on it, which is a logistical nightmare, I have to say, because obviously you're creating hundreds of different plate sizes. But it was a way of kind of evidencing materiality. In terms of this footage, interestingly, one of the only arguments, and I would say reasonably hostile argument we had, was with the family, survivor's family, a second generation family. was that they felt that we should use large imagery to evoke shock, horror, in a way that we didn't feel was appropriate. So I thought if at a distance, you would assume that we would be on the opposite side of this debate, if we're the sort of the big part of this national wanting to exploit this thing. But it was interesting. So our philosophy was to integrate imagery in context. Exactly as Yaneem said, I think there are, and this goes across the piece, like for example, the images of the exploitation of Jewish people out in the streets of Vienna in 1938 during the, you know, the Anschluss and the events around that. They're always used metonymically to somehow suggest pre-war Nazi violence in its totality rather than specifically what was happening in Vienna. And I think those images are not metonymic, they're specific. And so we tried to be really kind of diligent in integrating imagery. The imagery from Belsen, the film from Belsen, is used at scale in the way we don't do with perpetrator-derived imagery. That's another distinction. So we'd say images that are taken by Nazis or people sympathetic to Nazis have a different purpose and function, so they need to be handled differently. But in terms of the Belsen imagery, our philosophy was the people who filmed it in good faith to be seen exactly as it is in the gallery. So it's on a large screen because that's how they would have anticipated being seen themselves. But as we were saying before, it is, for me, an insoluble issue. Either you will have people saying you absolutely shouldn't use that in any context, or people saying you should always use that and you should stop asking the question. Those are irreconcilable perspectives. The one thing which I will say, and I'll stop talking in 2 seconds, is that it does reveal the discrepancy between curatorial or authorial intention and kind of reader review, because our intentionality behind using the film with that scare only in the final space is to integrate it, to say this is not metonymic for the whole thing. This is film shot at this specific moment in time because the Death March is the collapse in the Third Reich. Various other factors had led to this collapse in the system. And that's what the film testifies to. That was the idea. In some of our evaluation, visitors have said, oh, I really like the way they're in the last space. You smashed us between the eyes on that footage to really make the point. And I thought, oh God, no, that absolutely wasn't the idea at all. But it's somehow exactly to your point. It's almost so successful in doing that, you can't pull it back to where you wanted to stay. But I would say at every stage, we tried to think very carefully and kind of critically.
Yeah, it did strike me that the Bernstein film, or as far as you got with making that film, you show parts of that in the penultimate room, I think it is, of the exhibition. And it's quite a huge projection. Mm-hmm. So while it is said in the exhibition that you omit some of the most graphic images, it's still almost unwatchable in certain moments. But as you said, I also thought that it had a completely different position inside the exhibition, because we are at the point of, yeah, liberation and aftermath. And we've seen a lot before, and you've used also a lot of different visual media before that point in order to somehow contextualize these images for us. So I think in that regard, it shows maybe at a reverse. It's not the image you start with. It's not the shock image, you know, that frames the whole thing, but it's more shown as part of, I guess, the historical development.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as Yaneem said, that it's one of those kind of evolutions in world class museology. Anyone who's been to the museum in DC, the United States Montesborough Museum, the very first image is the pile of bodies in Old Jersey, because that was the part of the entry point to the American experience, wasn't it? And I think probably museological practice has moved on to say, if one of the kind of your core kind of obligations as somebody working in this field is to try and do something to desense the hegemony of the perpetrator to determine narrative, which we've certainly into world class museology, there's something in. If you first introduce people as the sort of what they would became as products of what had been done to them rather than who they are, it's virtually impossible to introduce any degree of agency or self-identity.
That's right. But if you look, for example, of, you know, after decades of imagery of the Holocaust, I think for many visitors to the American Holocaust Museum, the striking room is the one with the, you know, the shoes, mm-hmm. right? It's the kind of the physical material artifact seems to have in a sense achieved that shock value that I think the images did in 1945. There's a kind of sense in which they could see this as a kind of, as a room that spoke to a much, much larger issue. You've got a feeling of the scale, the amount of people involved. It's something that is, you know, as ordinary everyday life as these kind of abandoned shoes seem to have spoke to a lot of people in terms of that particular experience that wasn't mediated through a photo, but in this case, just through an everyday object. So I think that had its power. Now, well, the next generation of Holocaust Museum curators are seeking something like that, or in a sense have to work with everything that's been seen and curated already, or if there's still something out there that can reconstruct that feeling of a kind of, what do you want to call it, kind of dramatic encounter necessarily shock, a dramatic encounter with the historical moment, because now it's literally been mediated by so many layers now of imagery and objects. It's very, very hard to kind of seek that particular emotional value.
Yeah, I was going to say there's an expectation, right? Which one needs to take into account as a creator as well.
I think so. I mean, in some respects, I think the most shocking or upsetting images that I've encountered for the thing are the Lubni, which is, you know, the load of images taken just before my shooting in Lubni. There's one particular face of a lady sitting on the ground holding her child. Mm. And you know that they're sitting to the side of this, the place where they would be shot in the minutes and the hour ahead. And so there's something about the look on their face that is different from his territorial perspective. That sounds just difficult to sort. Right now, right, so I'm talking too much.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, because our ideas about creating these images, they clearly evolve. And it's just fascinating to see how we are now 40 years after the rediscovery of these images in the mid-1980s and how much that has changed in terms of our dealing with them. And yeah, this was maybe also going to be my last set of questions for you. And how do you think can we still use these images? We've heard James' perspective from a curatorial point of view. I think you could say still something about how they are actually received inside the exhibition by visitors, which opens up, you know, still another layer of difficulty. But yeah, do you think these images are still useful in a way for engaging us with Nazi crimes, with Holocaust?
Yeah, certainly useful as documents, absolutely.
I was very careful with that word. So wrong.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, my thing is always images are documents that should be treated as such. So yes, for certainly in an archive. I don't think there's a simple answer to that, because I think maybe one of the differences between the exhibition I showed you earlier on, is there was no narrative there. And I think in 1945, we just looked at the exhibition as far as we can see it, the Daily Express exhibition. They weren't constructing a narrative. It was just images, you know, shocking images designed to shock. And I think what we're doing maybe since the 1980s is creating narratives. So I think the use of pictures is dependent on what the narrative is and where it is, because, you know, in different countries, people create different narratives according to their, you know, own history, whether you're in Eastern Europe or Western Europe or America or wherever. So, yeah, I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I think we have to look at the narratives, but also I think just using shocking images for the sake of it, I'm not sure there's much purpose in that, actually, you know, without information and without researching the image to find out, you know, actually, what are we looking at? And you can apply that to one of the images I showed you in the exhibition. You know, what are we looking at? We don't really know. They're so shocking that we just react to the shock, and then it stops us from analyzing, I think, you know, what it is we're seeing.
I agree. And maybe part of that narrative is also, how does the story continue? With Bergen-Belsen, you have the story of the DP camp afterwards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that just creates a different kind of visual narrative.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And broadens the horizon, you know, when looking at these images.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me the exhortation, lest we forget, you know, 1945 is equally as valid today. And it does. I mean, the will toward documentation and to record the atrocities, it was very good at its taking place. It still has enormous value. It's a question, you know, where 1945, it served in many ways as moral outrage. That was, in a sense, it's, you know, the sense to show the Allies what, in fact, you know, the Germans had done to these people. But I'm not sure that value can be conveyed in the same way. So it's a question of then, I think, for curators and museum organizers to try to come up with a way that to convey the enormity and magnitude of what had happened. But in a sense, going to have to be different strategic museal forms in terms of conveying that message, because they've been tried and tested and they worked well. But now the worry is, for next generation, it's become very, I don't say banal, but it's been very routine driven, and it's very difficult to, in a sense, convey that the emotional punch that it once did.
And I think there is just that issue, which, fun enough, we were involved recently in a Sam Mendes project, which you might have seen, called What They Found on the BBC, a documentary using some of the AFPU footage. And I found myself thinking a lot about this question of saying, the sort of the latent humanity of the people whose corpses we see. I do worry that 80 years on, we're still what we were 80 years ago, that they the idea that they were once sentient people who had kind of identities and agencies and families and lives. I do worry that if anything, that's become reinforced to the point where it's almost impossible to claw back again because of the repeated body of it. And I wonder at what point it's possible to, or what it's possible to do about that.
Yeah. Although it has been said that television documentary is very cautious in its usage of the footage. I was very impressed by it. I think we have to draw the discussion to a close here, but for those present at the German Historical Institute London, there will be a reception now to which you will be invited and where we can continue the discussion over a glass or two. Before we do so, however, I'd like to thank very much again our speaker and our panelists for their input for the discussion. I'd like to thank again our hosts, the German Historical Institute London, and of course, our audience here in the room as well as online. Let me conclude by mentioning the next event in our series, which will take place at Deutsches Forum für Kunstgeschichte Paris on June 17th. This will be dedicated to the immensely popular post-war exhibition Crime Mittlerien. The event is entitled Scenography and Narration. And as discussants, we have invited Sylvie Lunzeperk and Rachel E. Perry. So we would be delighted to see you there. There will again be a Zoom live stream, so you can also follow and participate, even if you do not have the luck of being in Paris on that particular day. So thank you again for the discussion, and thanks to you for your input.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.